I'm Frank Vaughn. It's April 8th, 2026. There's some kind of ceasefire going on. We're going to talk about that next. But first, I want to answer a question from the audience because we're going to talk about Canada. Just for a second, Marcus Aetius says, spot on, Frank. One question. You live in Canada. We've met. Why are you America first and not Canada first? It's not that I'm America first. It's not that I am or I am not Canada first. Canada left me. I am more for independence for Western Canada than I am for anything else right now. It's the only vision on the board in Canada. There's nothing federally that's going to inspire me to feel any hope. This is why. This is just today. Conservative MP Marilyn Gladue crosses floor to Liberals. Ontario MP's defection bring the Liberals up to 171 seats. This is the fourth such MP. Several of these MPs from the Conservative Party I named months ago as potential soft underbelly candidates that would cross over to Carney as Carney drags the Liberal Party in many ways back to the center. Now, some people might not like that I say that. But when you look at what they're doing on immigration, when you look at what they're doing on bail reform, when you look at what they've done on the carbon tax, they've been eating the Conservative Party's lunch. And one of the reasons is these MPs, this soft underbelly, the Conservative Party has built its brand on catering to the center, catering to the left. They think if they just go Nerf ball enough, that support is going to leave the Liberal Party and go to them. Now that they've lost Justin Trudeau, as somebody that the Canadian public desperately hated at the end, now that they've lost that as a centre, as a central focal point for all of their anger, it doesn't matter if I accept Carney as the duly elected Prime Minister of Canada or as somebody that's actually good for the country. I don't. I think he's here to redirect our CPP into funds that undermine the United States. For a while, I thought that he was coordinating with the Trump administration. Now, unless the Trump administration is completely and totally coordinating with Europe, which I don't think that they are, I still don't think that today, it is my belief now, my firm conviction, that Carney is absolutely here on behalf of Europe to undermine the United States using Canadian resources to do that. And there's a great big bag of loot called the pension funds, not just the Canada Pension Fund, but all the public sector funds. An act of parliament can redirect those funds into investments that Carney sees not just to be beneficial to his own personal portfolio, but to be beneficial to his mission, which I believe is undermining the nationalistic structure that underlied America First and MAGA, even though the war has done a massive amount of damage to that base as it is. It doesn't matter what I think of Mark Carney. The reality is the nation, predominantly in the East, but also a little bit in the West, you know, you're looking at Vancouver, they've accepted Mark Carney as their leader. They've accepted him as the prime minister of the country, and they believe that he's doing a great job. I mean, look at this headline. We have, I just got to grab it. Why it would be extremely dumb for Canada to join the EU. This is by Tristan Hopper. This is the most anti-nonsense thing that you'll see in the National Post, but look at how Global News is covering it. Are Canadians open to joining the EU? Here's what a poll found out. Now, Tristan rightly points out, for one thing, non-European countries are literally not allowed to join. So the doors close to us unless the fundamental structure of the EU is changed and the member states sign off on that. And that's, at the very least, a very long road, quite likely to be incredibly unlikely. But Global News doesn't really want to talk about that. Global News's fixation is on the fact that Canadians are open to this idea. New polling suggests a majority of Canadians think Canada ought to explore joining the European Union at a fraught time for geopolitical relations. A survey of 4,000 people conducted by Spark Advocacy's polling arm in March found that 1 in 4 respondents thought it would be a good idea for Canada to formally join. A further 58% indicated it was a proposal worth exploring further. The Canadian mindset, you ask me why I'm not Canada first, the Canadian mindset is uniting around the destruction of the Conservative Party, the soft, milquetoast Conservative Party. They need to rebrand, and they need to rebrand quick. What they need to do is worry about building a new constituency out of the ashes of their old constituency, because it's falling apart. Their MPs are leaving. They got their heads in the sand, and they're pretending that nothing is wrong. Polyev was the absolute best leader that they had, the best spokesperson, the best debater, the strongest leader, and they milquetoasted him. They turned him into Nerf ball. They gave him talking points, and he lost the biggest lead that a party's ever had over its liberal opposition. And now the rats are jumping ship from the Conservative Party because they want their political careers to survive. They recognize the sinking ship. You can call these numbers fake all day. I'm sorry, but they're not. This is the Canadian mind. So I'm not Canada first, because Canada, as it's defined by its people, does not represent me. Western Canada, the values that underpin Saskatchewan, and Alberta, a large part of Alberta, a larger part of Saskatchewan. I live in Saskatchewan because this is the best last bastion of Western civilization that is in Canada. This is the place where the values that I support, that I espouse, that represent me, are best represented, but we are in a minority, a big minority. We're outnumbered, so there is no Canada first, because Canada, as it's defined, doesn't represent a national Canada. It represents European values. It represents the values espoused by Mark Carney. It represents anti-Americanism. That's our core identity, is that we're not American. Foolish. Our trade is north-south. The world cannot save us and get us and bail us out of a trade arrangement with the United States. We shouldn't even be trying to go for the exits. We should be trying to build that relationship. We should be trying to mend fences. We should be getting into business with America, regardless of whether it's Trump or Biden running it. The future is proximity. The future is geopolitical destiny. We have things that each other needs and we live right beside each other. This conflict, which I think is being played out on behalf of the City of London, on behalf of European bankers. Remember, I talk about, people keep saying, watch 2CTV, watch Promethean if you want to know what's going on. They tell half a truth. And the half truth that they tell is that there is a conflict between the European-centric world and the City of London and that banking class and the elites in the United States. A very real conflict that underpins everything that's going on. I don't want to be allied with a totalitarian Europe, even though they voted to open re-migration centers because they figured out mass immigration has been a complete and total nightmare. At the exact same time, Canada is starting to look at canceling those permanent residents. Canada is bringing down the population. Canada is kicking out the TFWs. The absolute best way to deal with the so-called housing shortage and the fact that housing is out of reach in terms of purchasing and in terms of rent, out of reach of the average Canadian, the simplest way to deal with that is to reduce the population. And that's exactly what the Liberals are doing. And that's why the Conservative Party is collapsing. It doesn't matter that they committed to building a 500,000 houses a year. They could never do that. And the Liberal base doesn't care that they're never going to do that. The Liberal base does not care that the Liberal Party didn't campaign on reforming immigration. They don't care. They just care that the Liberals are in power. It doesn't matter what I think. For my purposes, for the way that I view the world, for my gestalt, I need a strong national-centric United States. I need an isolationist United States. I need a United States that doesn't bury itself in the mountains of the Zagros. I need a United States that deconstructs its empire and focuses on a strong North America. I need a United States that can counter the globalist influence of my own government, which is well represented in the Canadian political mind. It's not well represented in mine, and that's the reality. I hope that explains and answers that question. One other question I want to briefly tackle is, Odds God says, why would you quit? I don't intend to quit. I'm going to be here. I'm going to keep doing this. What I was espousing and have espoused over the last 40 days, because it's been a difficult 40 days. It's been a long stretch with very little sleep, not just covering this war, but rebuilding out my tech and getting the studio ready. Like, I wouldn't have made the investments I've made if I intended to quit. What I'm talking about is, if my audience goes away, if the thing becomes financially untenable and unviable, I have to keep my family some other way. There's people who say, I live in my mom's basement and all I do is play Xbox and PlayStation all day. Uh-uh. I'm married. I have a family. I got to take care of business. And this is business, and I'm doing it. This is like the video game equivalent of hardcore mode when it comes to content creation. No sponsors, no ads, no YouTube partnership, no reach, because they're not going to help me algorithmically. It has to be done by word of mouth. You people need to build it. If you value the work, you need to share it. You need to figure out a way to get it out there. And I'm not saying that, like, I'm not trying to put that on you. It's just reality. The algorithm's not going to give me new eyes, especially when I'm talking the way that I'm talking about this conflict overseas. I've watched my reach dwindle to almost nothing on Twitter. It has nothing to do with the fact that the content isn't, that the audience doesn't want to see it. It has to do with the algorithm slowly phasing me out. Because the one thing that you're not rewarded for when it comes to the X platform is critique of anything coming out of the foreign policy of Israel. I'm not going to quit. When I talk about it ending, as I did at the end of yesterday's video, it's if the audience disappears, if it's financially untenable, if I can't keep it going. I'm going to keep it going for a long time. I wouldn't have built out my studio again if I didn't intend to keep going and keep going for a long time. But there might be an endpoint one day, because what I do is deeply unpopular at different times with different people. People come along. They like what I have to say. They follow. And then the truth, or the seeking of the truth, I'm not saying I'm the absolute arbiter of truth, but I do try to find it as a core philosophy of what I do. And sometimes it leads me down branches that are deeply unpopular with my audience. I'm still going to do it, because that's another thing. I will not be captured by my audience. I'm not going to just spoon feed you what you want to hear. I'm going to tell you what I genuinely think. And I'm going to provide and try to provide the evidence for why I think those things. And it's going to make you angry. And my solemn hope is that you'll stick with me anyway. And you won't just turn on me and start calling me a retard 500 times a day, which is what happens more often than not. Sure, it's a little bit demoralizing. And sometimes I think, especially over the last 40 days, that it might actually lead to the end of my viability. But I'm going to keep going until it's dead in the water, and then I'll go and do something else. It's not like I am driven to do this because this is what I necessarily love to do. I'm an introvert by nature. I can do this. I can do the work. I can go to debates. I can give speeches. I can do all that sort of stuff. But at the end of the day, I'm a hermit. I miss farming. I miss working with my hands. I miss the sweat and the blood in some ways anyway. I don't want to say I miss it fully. I certainly don't like the prospect of farming in Saskatchewan with all the ticks the way that I do it, because I'm not sitting in a tractor. I'm in the field sweating, growing vegetables, and like a holistic nursery style operation is pretty much the only thing I'm interested in. And there's aspects of that I really miss. But I like doing this because I feel like I'm trying to build an audience and trying to build an understanding and putting something out in the world that's kind of unique and going about it in a unique way that might have a chance of making the future better for my kids and their friends, those kids that I love. I want to leave something. I want to leave an influence. I want to be a pebble cast in a pond, casting ripples out over the years. Maybe I can do that. Maybe I can't. I'm not going to quit. All right, so we have to get back to the beginning of this video, which started with crowds celebrating. I just want to highlight the contrast. Those crowds were derived in Iraq and Iran, in cities all across both countries, waving Iranian flags, waving Iraqi flags, celebrating what they see from their perspective as the defeat of the United States and Israel in those countries in that region. I'm going to tell you why this is sort of fraught, that the ceasefire, I don't know if it's really a ceasefire. It's certainly the off-ramp that the United States needs, but I'm not sure, considering it's the security guarantor of the GCC countries, I'm not sure it's safe and effective at this point. But we'll get into that. I just want to contrast those scenes with what's happening in the United States. There are no spontaneous parades, no spontaneous rallies of American citizens gathered together celebrating this incredible victory that Hegseth this morning and Donald Trump through his social media has told us that they have achieved. It's not happening. MAGA is not turning out by the thousands to wave American flags and celebrate this monumental victory of the United States. So just to compare and contrast, you can see that things maybe aren't being welcomed in the United States the way that some might hope. Now, I'm just going to read a couple of my tweets, and we're going to go into what they mean. Trump's war objectives have not been met. And again, they're trying to ratio me, but they can't quite get there. And again, my audience is largely people who support Trump, and they forget that I have supported Trump since 2015 in many of the things that he's done. I'm not some kind of far-left lunatic. I'm not anti-Trump. I'm just pro-fact. The Iranian regime is in control and more powerful than ever. Trump himself said they needed regime change. Their goal is a different government. They talked about bringing back the Shah. And I've talked on this channel about how the Shah was overthrown in a popular revolution because the Shah was installed by the CIA after they took out the popular guy, Mossadegh, in 1953. While the Korean War was wrapping up, they were doing this thing in Iran that had long-term consequences. Not the Iranian Revolution that we're dealing with here. It's the interference of the CIA when Mossadegh tried to take the oil and give it back to the Iranian people by kicking out the British. The Shah came in, was a horrible, totalitarian, top-down regime. I could give a good damn what Iranian expats in Toronto and around the world have to say about what's happening in Iran today. They're descendants of people who were aligned with the Shah. Most of them have no living memory of this political cycle. They've been passed down from their parents, this view of what Iran is supposed to be and what it was that does not match the facts and reality of history. When the Iranian Revolution happened, it was popular. Millions were in the streets celebrating the arrival of Khomeini when he came back from Europe and his exile. At any rate, that regime, that Islamic constitution, is still in control today. They say they killed all the leadership. You're going to see pictures and billboards. I guarantee they're going to do this over the coming days as they try to brainwash everybody. You're going to see all of these figures in the Iranian government with X's through their faces. But the president survived. The speaker of the parliament survived. Many people, the foreign minister, one of the most articulate Iranians, Aragachi, am I saying that right? Doesn't matter. I know who he is. I have admiration for him. I have respect for him as a human being. He survived. There is continuity of the state. So the idea that the regime change has been accomplished is a myth that Trump is promoting to try and secure his base. The Iranians maintain significant ballistic and drone capabilities. They still have their drone speedboats. They still have the underwater torpedoes. They still have the prophylactate against the American military and the American Navy that they had since the beginning. There's a reason the United States never went close to the Persian Gulf. The commanders and the generals and the admirals all told the administration, if we go in there, it's a death trap. And they made significantly compelling cases about that. I think the sacking, when Hegseth sacked those various generals, there's been more than one, they said that what I believe happened is a special operation to go in and grab the uranium in Isfahan, and it failed, and that's why there's so much wreckage, and they concocted the story about rescuing a pilot to cover over the fact that they failed to secure the uranium in the special operation. I think they tried and they failed, and I think those generals got fired because they said it was going to be a fail. That is a bit of speculation, but what is not speculation is it was a disaster. The American military lost like $500 million in that one operation. Lives have been lost. Casualties have been racked up. Assets have been destroyed. Air assets have been destroyed. Air superiority was not generated over Iran. They still maintain significant air defense capabilities. These are just facts on the ground. The strait only opens, this is from my tweet, if Iran allows it to. Not only does it only open if Iran allows it to, they're now going to be allowed to charge tolls. They did not control the Strait of Hormuz before. They threatened to. But there was free maritime flow of traffic. Now Iran is going to limit that traffic to the boats that they want. This is with Trump and the administration's agreement. And they're going to charge a toll to those boats. This isn't a free and full restoration of traffic. Iran has full control now of the strait. That is a strategic loss. And they maintain full control of the uranium, even if it's buried underground. It's tough. Now, I want to go over this 10-point plan as the Iranians proposed it, because the Americans gave the Iranians a 15-point plan, which they rejected. They submitted their own 10-point plan, and Trump has agreed to it in principle. He said it's the baseline for negotiations. They commit to not building nuclear weapons. That's something the Americans had before the war was initiated. The Omani mediator that both sides agreed to said the Iranians were willing to give the whole thing up under American observation. And the Americans, probably at the behest and the convincing of the Netanyahu government, went ahead with the war anyway while they had that agreement. So they had that point already. On the table is provisions paving the way for a complete cessation of any aggression against Iran and allied groups. So guarantees of security, probably from China, Russia, the UN, the United States, even though the Iranians cannot trust their word. That's why they need stronger guarantees. Possible, that's possible, withdrawal of U.S. combat forces from the region and a ban on any attacks on Iran from regional bases. So they want a reduction in U.S. forces. That, in my mind, is a good thing. I said that the United States needed to deconstruct and reorganize the empire and focus on hemispheric defense over here in the Western Hemisphere and getting filthy rich while we do it and rebuilding the infrastructure and making this the beacon of high civilization in the world, using that time and treasure that is spent maintaining the empire and reconstituting it over here into just a Western hemispheric hegemon the world has never seen, that it would be so good for the people, not just of the United States and of Canada. So that's a good thing, but it's also, if the American objective is to maintain the empire, it's a loss. It's just a loss. Limited daily passage of ships through the Strait of Hormuz for 2 weeks under a safe passage protocol provision and specific rules dictated by Iran. That's a loss. Lifting of all primary, secondary, and UN sanctions against Iran, so they will now be able to make a lot of money. It will be good for the price of oil long term, but there's some issues, there's some bottlenecks, and there's some supply issues that are already baked in, as I've talked about in my previous videos. I don't want to languish there today. Covering Iran's losses from the war by creating an investment and financial fund for the country, acceptance by the U.S. of Iran's right to enrich nuclear material, and discussion on the level of enrichment. This is essentially what Obama and the Iranians agreed to. A civilian nuclear program is now on the table again. Permission for Iran to negotiate bilateral and multilateral peace treaties with regional countries, extension of non-aggression policy towards all resistance groups in the regions. This would include Hezbollah. We'll get into that next. This will probably include the Houthis. They're talking about a regional understanding that these forces and these peoples have a right to exist and have a right to resist their own oppression from their perspective. That's now on the table. Trump has accepted these in principle. Ratification of all commitments through official United Nations resolution. That's the last point. And somehow people want to spin this as a win for Trump. This leaves the United States in a worse position than they were in before the war started. It's amazing to see the pretzel logic. It's a maximal win for Iran. If it stands, then the United States might be able to negotiate some of these things off the table, but a lot of it's going to remain. And the fact is, Iran is now the master of the Persian Gulf. And if the Americans try to sail their ships into the Persian Gulf, the war will resume. This is just a ceasefire. This is not like a full peace. We have to remember that. And before we move on to why I'm skeptical about this peace, I just want to read one more thing. I've defended Trump over the years and supported many of his positions since 2015. I was an early adoptee. I watched the speech where he came down the escalator. I watched that live. I watched him talk about illegal immigration. And shortly thereafter, calling the fake media out for what they were as propaganda organs, talking about the Bushes, talking about how 9/11 principally was designed and implemented from Saudi Arabia. I was like, yes, man, if I ever wanted to hear this. And this was after my thesis, which I had had probably since 2005 and before, that the world would need a rebel billionaire to go against somebody from the elite class that would push back against the globalist agenda. And I thought, here's this guy. This looks pretty cool. So I've supported some of his ideas along the way. This idea that I'm a leftist and I've got TDS, I just have a better relationship with facts. I'm not in a cult. And so I said, I've defended Trump over the years and supported many of his positions since 2015, but I'm not capable of cultism. And after this chapter of the Iran saga, I'm convinced he could murder babies and many of his supporters would praise him for sending them to heaven. In fact, that's what the U.S. administration did when they bombed that school. They sent children, hopefully to heaven. And people just applauded it. And tried to blame the Iranians. They put their schools near their military bases. It's their fault. They don't even know that the United States does the same thing. You realize that on every American base in the world, there's schools, there's churches, there's facilities. If you zoom in on the military base in Kuwait, you'll find there's a great big pentagram. They even have a pagan church. for the U.S. personnel. There's also pictures of people dancing around the fires and everything. I haven't even had a chance to cover that on the channel yet. There are schools near American military bases. It's kind of a common practice. It's your responsibility to have a department that can vet your targeting. But the War Department in the United States has bragged about the fact that they've deconstructed that civilian oversight that would go through that target list and make sure it was up to date and make sure they were hitting the right things. They got rid of it because they call it red tape. They call it a shackle on the proper use of American military power. Well, they brag about the precision of their bombs and how they would only ever hit military targets, even as you can see with your own eyes, the videos coming out of Iran of residential buildings being collapsed and schools being hit and hospitals and universities and even a synagogue. Yesterday there was people who were laughing and calling me out saying, oh, it's just fake news. There's no Jews in Iran. There's like 30,000 of them. There's dozens of operating synagogues. And one of the last acts of this chapter of the war, because the war is not over yet, this is just the second chapter. Iran is 2-0 now. The Israelis and the Americans bombed that synagogue. And the Israelis have admitted and said that they regret it. They regret that they bombed that synagogue. And I'm going to try and keep this one short today for you, even though I always fail at doing that. Oil refinery in Iran struck despite ceasefire. Tehran strikes Kuwait and UAE. The UAE seems to want to continue this war. The Israelis are, let's just go through this. Iran says it attacked Kuwait, UAE after strikes on its oil facilities. So the GCC countries seem to be continuing. The ceasefire only sort of applies to the United States, whereas these countries are continuing the war. And where is the article? Israel hits Lebanon with massive wave of airstrikes. Does the ceasefire apply to Lebanon or doesn't it? You see, we're only hours into this. We're not even a full day into this so-called ceasefire, the details of which are pretty thin. And will it cause Israel to stop bombing Iran altogether? Will it stop the war in Lebanon, or will the war in Lebanon continue? Will the Iranians feel that the ceasefire should apply to Lebanon? All of these things, as I film this, are probably being negotiated. For all I know, they could be worked out already, or they could be an issue of contention. This agreement that they've come to is very fragile. And I want it to be understood that the escalatory ladder was getting to the top. The Iranians, I would say, had one card that they could play still, and that was the closure of the strait in the Red Sea. They could have activated the Houthis and they could have closed that strait. And that action might have been one more step up the escalatory ladder that wouldn't have led to total conflagration for the Middle East. But both sides were getting to the point where they were right on the precipice of the United States, through Donald Trump, threatening to end the Iranian civilization and saying that would it never rise again. A war crime, a crime against humanity. You now have voices in the U.S. House and in the U.S. Senate calling for impeachment. And I'm telling you, the political fallout and damage of this is going to carry on for years. The economic damage is going to carry on for years, even if this actually turns into a permanent peace agreement. But that was a signal that you're at the end of the rope. There's not much more room to go. And the Iranians, for their part, said, we're going to blow up the entire region. We're going to take out all that oil infrastructure. We'll go for the desalinization plants. If you hit our power plants and you hit our facilities, we will return in kind. And it's my belief, and again, this is speculation, but I think this is where the Chinese and the Pakistanis and the Indians and all the people who were trying to mediate the ceasefire and get it into place, they said, that's a bridge too far for us. Because we're dependent on your energy. So we're not going to stand idly by and allow you, even if it's retaliatory, to blow up these facilities. We won't be able to support you in that endeavor. So we got to find an off-ramp. We got to find a way to de-escalate this thing and try to get something done piece-wise, which is not guaranteed. Like I said, it's an incomplete ceasefire. Stuff is still blowing up. So the war, this chapter of this war, which I don't think you can put a bookend on it yet, I don't think you can call it done, has pretty much gone as far as it can before it unleashes destruction in a way that creates permanent and lasting damage to the entire global economy in a way that exceeds what's already been done. There is damage that's already baked in. The harshest damage is the political damage that's done to the Trump administration and to MAGA and America First. Like I said, the Arab world is celebrating this as a victory, and they have cause to, especially from their perspective, but from an impartial perspective, Like I said at the beginning of this, all Iran had to do was survive and remain combat effective. They didn't have to destroy every single military asset. They got a lot of them. They damaged a lot of bases. They blinded the early warning radar systems. So missiles were raining down on Israel, and the Israeli people had no warning. That's because the Iranians were combat effective. They maintained, in spite of the fact that the United States sunk a lot of surface naval assets and power, battleships, cruisers, things like that, big ships, relics of a former era. They maintain their drone speedboats. That's how they are hitting those tankers. They maintain their underground or underwater torpedo capacity. It's very likely, I've never seen proof of this, but it's very likely that they have underwater launching tunnels built along the coast of the Persian Gulf where they can launch these torpedoes and hit targets. That's why the American Navy could never sail in there. All Iran had to do was survive and remain combat effective, and the regime had to survive, which it did, because the regime is designed to be very decentralized, so it's highly survivable. There is no head of the snake that you can kill that will eliminate the regime. It's a thousand-headed snake by design. I mean, I wish people would really look into this. This is what makes the Iranians so difficult to deal with. A conventional army designed for wars that were fought 50 years ago cannot defeat a modern guerrilla army. And that's what it is. It's a guerrilla army with a state that is using ballistic missiles and drones and autonomous, small, cheaply built naval and aerial assets. They don't need an air force built of planes and bombers because they have a modern military, the kind of military that the Chinese are building, the kind of military that's fighting the war between Russia and Ukraine. That's the future. Aircraft carriers are the past. And we're very slow to realize that on this side of the planet. So at any rate, it's not over by any stretch of the imagination. And we all need to keep observing this. I'm glad, like, don't get me wrong. This is good news. That they didn't climb off the top. Like, it's like the escalatory ladder, and then you get to the top and everybody just falls off and breaks their faces. I'm glad we stopped that here for a little while. But it's not over. I'm Frank Vaughn. I'll see you in the next one.